Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
Thanks so much for joining us.
We'll begin by reflecting on a landmark novel that helped fuel the sexual revolution.
The surprising science that will transform your sex life.
Then, celebrating the end of a union in style.
Plus, the joys and challenges of being a grandparent. Advice from an expert.
And we'll shoot the breeze about free art masterpieces.
Believe it or not, it's been 40 years since Erika Jong's groundbreaking Fear of Flying was first published. Over 27 million copies have been sold, and it's even come out in Chinese. The book has become a classic, with a story of Isadora Wang, who coined a new phrase for a sex act and launched a new way of thinking about gender, sexuality, and personal freedom.
We are thrilled to have Erika Jong on the phone with us from New York City to give us the scoop on her landmark novel, what she thinks about feminism today, and whether romance and dating have become quaint relics of the past. Welcome to the show, Erika.
Thank you.
Well, as Kathy said, I mean, it's the 40th anniversary of the publication of this fabulous book, and I don't know how that can be because I remember reading it as a teenager like it was yesterday and hiding it under my mattress so my brothers wouldn't see it. And I sure learned a thing or two, I have to tell you, Erika.
Oh, well, I'm really glad I'm educational.
And I think my brother snuck a peek, too, and they learned a thing or two, too.
Speaking of your books and Fear of Flying, which was all about women and sex and the fact that women could actually like sex, can you imagine? Wasn't that really that concept, Erika, pretty revolutionary when the book first came out in 1973?
You know, Gore Vidal used to say we live in the United States of amnesia, and I often repeat that. Women like sex. Are you kidding? We know that women like sex in Chaucer. We have the wife of Bath, who has had six husbands. In America, we had a sexual revolution that followed our getting the vote. As soon as women could get diaphragms, they started to make love, not war. If you go back to the 1930s, the 1920s, you see there was a whole bohemian intellectual set who loved sex and talked about it. I mean, this is ridiculous. What happens with feminism in America is we tend to bury it. Every generation has to rediscover it, which is really a crime. A crime.
Well, Erika, you know, another thing that really struck us about your book is in the 70s, it wasn't unusual to have sex talk in a book,
right,
but to have sex described from a woman's point of view. I mean, that was really rare, right?
Very rare. And look around at the books being published by women and tell me if we've made progress.
No. You're thinking of 50 Shades of Grey, I'm sure.
Well, one of them is 50 Shades of Grey, but that's just one really terrible book in which, and I had to read it, all three parts of it, because everybody asked me about it.
I couldn't get through book one, personally.
I read every cover to cover, but it was horrible. It was a terrible book.
There were a million repetitions per page. Every time she had an orgasm, she said, holy cow or holy
and she
not
wasn't
exactly a compliment to your partner.
And she wasn't exactly on a voyage of self-discovery either. I mean, she was being dominated by a rich guy.
Yeah, and how did he get her? She couldn't afford a computer. He got her a computer. She mm-hmm. couldn't afford a car. He got her a car. This is new.
Right.
Women mm-hmm. having sex for things. Wait a second. This is not new. I mean, okay, so he bought her all kinds of stuff she couldn't afford. They had a contract. She was to be the submissive and he was to be the dominant. This is new? Not to me, it's not. I thought we had reached a point. I remember when Princess Di married the so-called heir to the throne, and people were opining on the editorial page of the Times and the Washington Post that she was a virgin. I remember thinking, wait a second, didn't we stop marrying princes because they gave us nice sapphire rings with diamonds? What is going on here?
Well, Erica, let's, you know, talk about your heroine, Isadora Wing, in Fear of Flying. And on a plane to Vienna, she's quite a nervous flyer, and she's afraid of terrorism and hijackings. I mean, really not unlike today, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there's been endless conjecture about the symbolism of the airplane and the fear of it. And after 40 years, will you please let us in?
I am not afraid of flying anymore. My daughter was after she had her three children, which is pretty common that women get very scared after they become mothers. Before that, Molly was not afraid of flying, and she flew all over promoting her books. Now, then she had three kids, and she got very nervous. I think the symbolism of the plane is independence and adventure. I think that as the plane goes up, it's a symbol of freedom, and it's a symbol of exploration of a world beyond the world in which you live. And for women, that's frightening. The fact that it's still frightening is amazing to me, but it is a symbol of freedom, and really the whole book is about the fear of freedom. There's a point in the middle of the book when Isadora is in a ratty Paris hotel and she's looking in a mirror, and it's a dialogue between herself and her soul. And she's looking in the mirror and saying, "Why is being alone so terrible? If no man loves me, I have no identity." And herself says back to her, "But that isn't true. People read your books and they're moved by them. You don't have to have a man in order to feel valuable." And she says, "But none of that makes a dent in my loneliness. I have no man. I have no child." And she goes back and forth for about two pages, which I really think is the center of the book, saying, "But if no man loves me, I have no identity." But you do have an identity, and your identity is writer, communicator, liberator, whatever. And then she fantasizes about Simone de Beauvoir and Sartre. Then she fantasizes about Sylvia Plath, and she says, "Dead. Who wants a life or death like hers, even if you become a saint?" And she starts to talk about all the women writers who killed themselves. So I think that is really what the book is about, the fear of flying, the fear of the imagination, the fear of freedom.
Our guest is Erica Jong, poet and author of several books, including Fear of Flying, which caused a national sensation. I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on iHeartRadio app or at iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Erica Jong about the uninhibited Isadora Wing's adventures and misadventures. Okay, Erica, so speaking of fantasies, there's Isadora's fantasy, of course, about a zipless, and we can't say the real word on the air, but let's just say intercourse. And it's really a major...
I say a zipless bleep.
I know. Okay, bleep. That sounds better. It has fewer syllables. And of course, it's a major motif in the story. And, you know, I looked it up. It's even in the Urban Dictionary. And it's described...
It's in the OED by now. It's amazing.
Oh, it's fabulous. So yeah. How would you describe the zipless bleep in today's jargon? What does that mean?
It's a hookup. Our kids call it a hookup, and you may not even know the name of the person, but you have the most extraordinary sex, absolutely ecstatic sex with this person whose name you don't know. And Isadora says the zipless bleep is a platonic ideal. And I have never had one.
It's a platonic ideal?
Uh-huh.
Why platonic?
Because, she says, it's rarer than the unicorn. It's an ideal. In other words, what she's saying is it's a fantasy, and in reality, it mostly doesn't work.
And would you describe it as like the perfect one-night stand?
Yep. And I think that for women, they are very, very rare. And I'll tell you why. When a man has a hookup with a new, pretty young woman, whether it's the greatest orgasm of his life or not, he notches his belt. It's a triumph. Maybe the sex is not the best sex of his life, but he doesn't think that way about it. He thinks, another woman I slept with. Men think that way. They're numerical. When they're young, I have to put that caveat in. So he has triumphed. For a woman, having sex with a man who doesn't know you, doesn't know how you reach orgasm, doesn't give you the most pleasure in the world. Better sex is had, in general, with somebody who knows the way you respond, knows your body, cares about your pleasure. That is without a doubt. Now, are there women who will say to themselves when they're in college or graduate school, wow, I got another guy? Yes, we imitate the men in that way when we're young. But the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm a plaster caster. Do you remember the plaster casters?
Mm-hmm.
I got a plaster mold of the penis of Mick Jagger.
Ooh. Oh, my goodness. I won't ask you how you did that. But
well, I didn't personally do it. I'm saying women brag about that.
Uh-huh.
So the plaster casters would come with a wet plaster and would get, you know, one of the Beatles or Mick Jagger, somebody like that. And they'd say, oh, look what I have. I have a cast of his penis. Great. That's great when you're a teenager or you're in your 20s. But did you have pleasure? Who knows?
Well, Erica, I want to know where you display that plaster caster.
I have one in my house in Connecticut.
Does it have his name like, under it with a plaque or
is
something?
Is it like in your foyer?
Actually, a sculptor, when Fear of Flying became a phenomenon, a sculptor sent me this amazing marble facsimile of his own penis.
It's
a work of art, and it sits on a shelf, but I never met him.
Oh, boy. I'd love to see
fantasy.
That one.
Fantasy.
Ah. So is there a lot of these plaster Mick Jagger appendages floating around, or do you have one of the
few? I have no idea. That's another show you should do.
I should. I think I'm going to Google that after this conversation.
No, the plaster casters were very young women who just screamed and yelled when they met rock stars, and they found a way. Probably the rock stars were very stoned.
Probably. A little out of it, and then they would notice something being coating their appendage.
remember the 70s? You know how people always say, if you can remember the 70s, you weren't really there?
Oh, yeah. We have a few memories.
So, I mean, that's what we're talking about here. These girls, you know, who wanted as an example of their power to show off that they were able to make a plaster cast on the appendage of a stoned guy. Not so hard. Everybody in those days got so stoned.
But Erica, don't you think women these days still want, I'm sure younger women still have their meaningless hookups, but don't you think underneath it all, they still really want dating and romance?
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. Completely.
In this post-feminism era, you know, feminist era.
It's hardly a post-feminist era. I mean, thank you. Thanks to the Republican Party, we have a resurgence of feminism. They keep passing these unconstitutional laws in which they stick probes up women's vaginas. And for the first time in a long time, younger women are waking up and realizing, oh, my God, we could lose it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're dying to know, is it true that Fear of Flying may finally be made into a movie?
It seems to be happening.
Wow. And why?
I am so superstitious that I'm afraid to even talk about it.
Okay. Will it be in our lifetime?
We have the financing. We have the script. We have the casting. But I cannot say anything else.
Ooh. Okay. Well, we can say it's about time.
Yes. And we'll keep our appendages crossed for you.
Thank you so much.
Erica John, prolific author and poet, congrats on the 40th anniversary of Fear of Flying. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you. Great fun.
These days, it seems as if every other commercial on television is touting some kind of treatment for our dismal sex lives. Whether it's low libido, painful sex, or being able to be ready whenever the mood strikes, in a bathtub no less, there's a prescription for it. Just add it to the ever-growing list of maladies we boomers seem to have.
That's why it's so refreshing to talk with our next guest, Emily Nagoski. She's a sex educator and author of Come As You Are, The Surprising Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. I love the title of that book. Emily joins us to chat about women's sexuality and why, despite the hype, we're all a pretty normal bunch. Welcome to the program, Emily.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you.
Well, for a while now, actually for a few years, we've been hearing about the development of this pink pill for women, you know, designed to kind of function like Viagra does for men. But so far, we understand the drug has been rejected by the FDA twice. So what's the problem? Why isn't it getting approved?
Because it doesn't work and it isn't safe, essentially. They're trying to develop a drug that will help women want sex spontaneously and out of the blue. And the difficulty is, it turns out, what the research over the last 15 years has told us is that wanting sex spontaneously and out of the blue is fun, but it's not actually a necessary part of healthy sexual functioning.
But many women do express that they experience low sexual desire, at least occasionally. What are some of the reasons?
Oh, there are so many reasons. It's actually normal for your interest in sex to ebb and flow, depending on your context. So it's normal when you're in the hot and heavy falling in love stage of a relationship, for example, for that to light the fire of sexuality in your emotional brain. And it's also normal if you're feeling really stressed out or exhausted, or if your body has changed and you're not sure how you feel about that, for those things to sort of hit the brakes in your emotional brain and turn off your interest in sex temporarily.
Okay, well, you talk about, Emily, spontaneous desire and responsive desire. So what's the difference between those two?
Spontaneous desire is the desire we're mostly taught is how it's supposed to work, where you're just walking down the street or sitting at lunch, and you have this internal urge, this desire to, I would like to have some sex now. Let me go find some sex.
Oh,
wow.
Gee, I don't know if I've ever experienced that.
It is. It's absolutely one of the ways that people experience desire, and it's normal. And it turns out it's not the only normal way to experience desire. It's also normal if, so for example, you're just sitting around reading a magazine and your partner starts caressing your arm and kissing your neck and your body goes, oh, right, sex, that's a good idea. We should do that. So it's a response. The arousal comes first and the desire emerges in response to the arousal. And that is also a normal way. It may not occur to you out of the blue, but there it is.
So how do most women experience this desire? I mean, I would think it would be more on the responsive side.
It turns out it's approximately 15% of women are primarily spontaneous. And everybody else, it mostly depends on the context. Some women are exclusively responsive. Maybe 30% of women are exclusively responsive in their desire style. But for most women, the majority, it's depends on the context. There are contexts where it feels totally spontaneous. You're on vacation, you're really relaxed, it feels spontaneous versus you're really stressed out and exhausted and it's more responsive then.
Well, what about men? What about those guys? Are
Absolutely.
They, you know, are they both desire styles, you know, normal and healthy?
Yeah, I have gotten an amazing number of emails from guys in response to the op-ed saying, thank you so much for giving me language to describe what's been going on with me. Men very much are forced into the stereotype of wanting sex all the time, no matter what. And it really turns out there's some research that would say that just as many men experience responsive desire as women.
It's very interesting. So we all need to go a great hotel, right?
You need to go home and
turn
hit on your guy,
phones.
I guess.
Long hot bath, light some candles, lock the bedroom door.
Yeah, what's the big deal about the bath issue?
We don't get that, but oh well, it's another show, Kat. Okay, so let me ask you, Emily, what if we lack both spontaneous and responsive desire? I mean, that can't be a good thing.
And we're not talking about us.
Oh, never.
So something like 5% of women do lack both spontaneous and responsive desire. About 1% of women actually identify as asexual, where they just don't have interest in sex. It's like their sexual orientation, basically, and that also is just a normal variation. It can be complicated in a relationship where one partner is asexual and the other is sexual. But for the remaining women, the most common reasons why women lack all kinds of desire is having a history of sexual trauma, there's actually a linear relationship between number of kids and amount of desire.
But, you know, isn't it natural to lose some of this as we age? I mean, isn't there a point where maybe we do just lose the spontaneous and responsive desire, or maybe that's
a wives' tale?
So, that'd be a bummer. I don't know if it's natural. Spontaneous desire does seem to diminish over the course of the lifespan. There's no biological reason that anyone has been able to find for why that happens. So it might be cultural or it might be psychological. But the reverse also happens. There are women who really struggle with their sexuality early in their lives. And as they age, they let go of a lot of cultural baggage and find themselves freed up sexually and experiencing more pleasure and arousal and desire than ever before in their lives. So both of those things happen.
You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes. We're talking about women's sexuality with Emily Nagoski, sex educator and author of Come As You Are, The Surprising Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. Emily, you write that every woman has her own unique sexuality, like a fingerprint, and that women vary more than men in our anatomy and the way our bodies respond sexually. So are you saying we shouldn't judge ourselves based on our best friend's 8 orgasms a week?
Absolutely.
Lucky
and
girl.
Your friend shouldn't judge herself based on your sexuality. We are all different from each other, and something that works for one woman will not necessarily be what works for another woman.
So it's not a competition, Kathy.
Exactly, Barbara.
Right. Okay. Okay. So, Emily, you say it's not what you do in bed or how you do it, but how you feel about it. So tell us what you mean by that.
So your emotions are how you feel. Your meta-emotions are how you feel about how you feel. And it turns out the single best predictor of overall sexual well-being is your capacity to turn toward your sexuality with kindness and compassion, accepting it as it is right now and welcoming your sexuality, enjoying the sex you're having, rather than trying to have some other kind of sex you feel like you're supposed to be having.
Can you give us some tips on how to do that, Emily?
The main skill is called non-judgmental awareness, where you notice what's happening inside your body and you just allow that to be true. You don't judge it as right or wrong. You don't tell yourself you should be feeling that way or you shouldn't be feeling that way. You just notice what's happening and allow it to be true.
And then you also talk about how confidence plays into sexual desire. How do you kind of build that if you don't really have so much?
The mojo. The sex
mojo.
How do
you get your mojo back?
Confidence and joy is my mantra over and over and over again. For me, confidence is about knowing what's true about your individual body. So education is a piece of that. And simply paying attention to and noticing and respecting your own body is part of that. And joy If confidence is knowing what's true, joy is loving what's true about your body, even if it's not what you were taught to expect it was supposed to be.
So, Emily, what would you say is your single most important piece of advice or something that someone can do to really improve their sex life?
I think the most important thing people can do is to begin being aware of and trusting their bodies. As women, we get taught to believe other people's opinions about our bodies more than we believe our actual own internal experience. So if we can let go of those messages we've been receiving telling us that we're doing it wrong and trust our own bodies, that is the beginning of real empowerment.
Wow. So, Emily, you wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times. It really created quite a stir, and it really, you got tons of readers. Why do you think this topic resonates so much with women?
The model we've been taught about sexuality, I think, is so based on the way the usual male sexual response works. So we're supposed to work the way men do with spontaneous desire, which is sort of more typical of men, and a bunch of other things. And we've been told that if we don't work the way men work, then we're broken. But what the last 20 years of science has showed us is that there just are some differences in the way women experience sexual arousal and desire from the way that men do. And I think women are really ready to hear a message that says, actually, you're not broken just because you're not a man.
Emily Nagoski, author of Come As You Are, The Surprising Science That Will Transform Your Sex Life. Great conversation. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Up next, celebrating the end of a union in style. Stay with us.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
There are all kinds of ceremonies marking life events, be it marriage, graduation, baptism, and bar mitzvahs. Well, add another life event to the list, divorce, which boomers are doing in record numbers.
New York Times journalist Abby Ellen has written a much-shared article about this growing trend and some unusual ways that couples are choosing to mark the end of their unions. The article is called Untying the Knot and Bonds of Marriage. Welcome to the show, Abby.
Hello. Thank you.
Okay. I completely understand, you know, having ceremonies and celebrations that mark happy occasions like baptisms, births, all that good stuff, marriages. But divorces are, you know, kind of contentious and not very happy. Why are more and more people really starting to mark this occasion with some sort of ceremony?
Because it's like putting the period at the end of the sentence. It's just closing it, you know? It's ending it. And some people really need that kind of closure, more so than what the paper says, right? More than just signing it. They need some kind of symbolic going off into the great unknown.
Maybe it's like the, yoo-hoo, I finally ditched the jerk.
Exactly. And any excuse for a party, right?
Any excuse for a party. Right. Why not?
Exactly.
Well, okay, Abby, let's talk about some of these divorce ceremonies that you write about. Tell us about the couple that traveled to the Great Wall of China and then took like a 90-mile hike. I mean, that is a whole lot of togetherness for people that are splitting up.
No, it was 90 days.
Oh, days.
90 days.
I'd kill them. On the 12th day.
Here's what it was. It was Marina Abramovich, the performance artist, and she had her longtime partner, Ule, if I'm pronouncing that right. So what they decided is they were going to do some kind of art spectacle about their split. So she was on one end of the Great Wall of China, and he was on the other. And after 90 days, they met in the middle, and they embraced. And then they officially parted ways.
Oh my
and
God.
So basically it was their way of just kind of symbolizing the end of their union.
But they didn't walk together. They did not walk together.
No, they did not walk together.
Okay, that makes more sense.
It makes more sense. No, but they met in the middle and then they just kind of high fived and went on their way. No, I think they actually kissed. But
I picture him throwing him off the wall.
Yeah, I know. I was going to say pushing him off.
I have been to that wall. You know what? That's a long walk. Yeah. I have to say. I mean, it's exhausting. So at that point, it's, you just say enough already. Go, go, go on your own way. I'm done with you.
Okay, now here's another one. What about the couple that had a very unique ceremony in Colorado, I believe, but it included a rope? I mean, what were they going to do? Like hang each other?
Or themselves. They had this rope. Yeah, they were at this lodge in Colorado. There was a roaring fire. And basically, the person, they had an officiant. You know, they have now people who officiate at these ceremonies. And they had sent out a questionnaire in advance asking the couple to describe what they were letting go of and what they would miss about each other. And at the ceremony, he handed them a rope made of two different colored strands. And the couple each took turns expressing what they were going to leave behind while they were cutting the cord. Literally, metaphor. And then it was over. They each had half of the rope. And so the officiant said, and I quote, "Now you're literally at loose ends, and it's up to you to choose how to weave these things together in your new life."
Oh, my God.
I know. It's, you know, you can get chills thinking about this. But
or gag. I'm not sure which one.
But, you know, it's funny because, I mean, it's a little woo-woo-y, but one woman said, you know, it provided a way to acknowledge the good things we had together and gave us a continued path for forgiveness and moving on. You know, and it was draining, but it was also very releasing.
Yeah.
That's, you know.
Well, Abby, apparently some divorcees go all out and have huge bashes to mark the occasion, a sparing no expense. So what's the most over-the-top celebration that you've written about?
There was one that there was a woman who threw a party. I mean, she really threw a party. And what she did was she decided to have all of her friends. She had 80 people in a nightclub, and she gave them all candles, and she wore this shimmery cocktail dress, and she marched into the rooms to the sound of beating drums. And at this nightclub, she reclaimed her maiden name, and her mother slipped a ring on her finger, onto the wedding finger, and, you know, gave a little ceremony, and then everybody was kind of clapping and dancing and music. It was a big to-do.
Huh. Was the husband there, the soon-to-be ex-husband?
No, the husband was not there. However, I wrote about another couple, and they walked around a labyrinth together, one of those kind of maze things, and that was their way. And they did that together and kind of went on their own path. Huh. So, you know, they each walked into the center, shared memories of their life together, and then they kind of, I don't know, hugged or shook each other's hands, and then they walked out separately.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Abby, we really thought it was interesting that you wrote that some experts actually say that these type of ceremonies can be really good if there are children involved.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So what about that?
It is. Well, here was the thing. So a lot of times kids, you know, they're kids when their parents split up, and they need some kind of closure themselves. The parents are going through their own thing, but there's nothing really there for the kids. And I spoke to this one woman who was 27, and her parents had split up when she was 10. So that was, 17 years ago. And she said she'd wished there'd been some kind of ceremony for her and her sister, because she felt like her world had been torn apart, and she didn't know what was happening. And she really wished that she had gotten some kind of closure herself. Mm. And it was very interesting that, you know, she wanted that, something for the kids to know that they were still loved and, you know, that they were both, that it wasn't their fault.
Right.
That
right.
It wasn't their fault.
Okay, yeah. Abby, I got to tell you.
Tell me.
A part of me is rather skeptical about this whole divorce ceremony business, you know, and it just seems like it's a great way to make money off of people who are really going through a tough time, you know, with hiring the caterers and flying people in and the florists and all this stuff. I mean, do you share this skepticism at all?
You know, I'm not married, so my skepticism begins before I even get divorced.
You were born a skeptic.
Yeah, so I've deliberately never gotten married. I think it depends, right? Because some of these ceremonies were over the top, a bit over the top, but some of them were really pretty basic. I mean, there's not a lot of expense when you're cutting a rope. And so what it is, if you feel like you need that kind of closure, if you need, you know, if you're getting something out of that, then I don't know that I can really condemn you for that or be skeptical of that. If that's what gets you, you know, if that gives you some kind of a modicum of peace, then good for you.
Exactly.
You know, that's my opinion. But.
Well, New York Times writer Abby Allen, this has been fun, and I hope Kathy and I don't ever have to put into play your ideas.
Me neither.
Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer
you.
Babes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Rumor has it that being a grandparent is one of life's most wonderful experiences. After all, we've raised our kids and we've learned our own parenting lessons along the way, hopefully, and now it's time to enjoy and perhaps help care for those little bundles of joy.
With all the pleasures that grandchildren can bring, there are also the challenges of adjusting to and respecting the new roles that our children have taken on, that of being a parent, and how we fit into the mold and strengthen our relationship with them along the way.
Returning to give us great family relationship advice is Dr. Ruth Nemzoff, a resident scholar at Brandeis University and an expert on parenting adult children and family dynamics. She's the author of Don't Roll Your Eyes and joins us on the phone from Boston. Welcome back, Ruth.
Hi, great to be back. Great to know the success you gals have had.
Ah, thanks, Ruth. Well, you know, when grandkids arrive, we often hear that we should just shut our mouths and don't give unsolicited advice. I mean, after all, we want to help and support, but not be in the way or make enemies, you know, with our new daughter or son-in-law. What's your take on that?
Well, my take on it is that being a grandparent is complicated, just like being a parent is. And certainly when our children are the caretakers 24/7, we want them to make decisions that they feel good about. If we see something that we think is life-threatening, we clearly have to bring up that subject. And it not necessarily, I mean, hopefully not in a critical way, but asking perhaps a question like, in my day, we were told, let's say, to put the baby to sleep on their stomach. Has the advice changed? And the answer, of course, is yes, the advice has changed. Because we found that SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, is less likely when the child is to bed on the back. So that would be an example. But if you're really worried about the safety of the child, you want to mention it. You know, we're all confused about what respect is. So for the kids, you know, hopefully, by that I mean the adult kids, the parents actually, they really hopefully can enjoy what the grandparent has to give and not criticize them for what they don't have to give.
Well, Ruth, do you think that even before we get to that point, that when the baby is coming, you know, the baby's brewing, right, should we really kind of sit down and sort of talk about our new roles and sort of to set ground rules?
I think that would be a fabulous idea if you could possibly do it. Now, remember, each relationship is different. And remember, each grandparent is different. So some grandparents are so excited to be grandparents and, you know, they're really just looking forward to babysitting. And others feel, you know, been there, done that. I've done my time. I don't want to do it anymore.
And don't you think those rules might change, too, after the baby's born? You
oh,
know?
Absolutely.
Like, how do you even
Can you
know?
Think of all the things you were going to never do and then you did? After the children were born.
Exactly.
Well, you know, Kathy and I weren't so lucky to have our parents babysit because, you know, we lived overseas when the kids were young. But mm-hmm. for those grandparents who do have the great fortune to watch their grandkids once in a while, should right. they just kind of blindly accept these parents' rules? I mean, or should we just kind of do our own thing and just trust our gut instincts?
Well, I think that usually we should follow the parents' rules, but we don't show them respect if we follow them blindly. And by that, I mean when you delegate any job to anybody, you've got to allow them a certain responsibility to go with the flow. And particularly in child rearing, where the mood changes, the situation changes in a nanosecond, you have to give the grandparents as a parent, you have to give the grandparents some discretion. So certainly I think grandparents should follow the feeding rules, because why not? What difference does it make? Unless, of course, they're just feeding the child candy all day.
You also really do talk about the balance between experience and, say, current thinking about child rearing. Because I know when we had our kids, but we read probably every single book there was possible to read, you know. You become sort of these experts before you've even had the baby. But yet your parents have really lived through it and raised successful kids. So how do you balance that?
Well, I think with a great deal of thought and a great deal of difficulty. And by that, I mean, really, one of the things you learn as a parent is to modify the expert opinion to fit your child, to fit your situation, to fit all the other siblings in the family, to fit the extended family. And I think that's the grain of wisdom that the grandparents have to bring to the situation. On the other hand, if it isn't particularly burdensome, why not follow the parents' rules? They are with the child 24/7. And this is, of course, we're talking about recreational grandparenting.
Right.
And we just come in and have a lovely day or two and help out. That's very different. And in that case, I think you follow as much as you can the children's orders, but discuss when you do have a disagreement.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Ruth Nemzoff about creating a lasting relationship of respect between parents and grandparents. Okay, Ruth, you were talking about, you know, it is probably better to follow the parents' rules. But I have to tell you, I have an ex-sister-in-law who shall not be named. But when my parents would babysit, she would give a 5-page list in detail about exactly when they should be fed and, you know, at what nanosecond they should be put to bed. And I know my parents always were a little taken aback by that. How should a grandparent handle that situation with very nervous parents?
I think reassuring the parents and saying, I will try to follow this as close as I can. But of course, you do realize if the baby is hysterical, I may need to keep them up a few minutes longer as I cuddle them and reassure them. And just honestly say that you will do your best, but you do want to have permission to react to situations which arise.
Do you think there is a different dynamic or perhaps maybe different expectations if you are, say, the grandparent to the dad, to the new father, or if you are the grandparent to the mother? Is there a different dynamic that kind of goes on within that relationship? And then it filters down, of course, maybe to the grandchildren.
Absolutely, there's a different relationship. You know, one of the things with your own children, you've had many, many disagreements. You have fought, you have, you know, had tantrums, you've done whatever children do, and still you and your parents know there's a bond of love. When an in-law enters the family, you haven't had that history. So it takes years to build that kind of trust. Can we get past the pleasantries and so forth? So when mother, particularly in those early days where the mother is nursing, perhaps, and having more role in the child's lives, although even today, even though men are much more involved, they're not quite as involved as the women on average, although in a particular family, it might be different. It is tricky because you don't know if something you say the person will take as criticism, where your own child might say to you, "Oh, mother, I've heard that spiel before." You know, perhaps not so respectful, but
Barb and I are shaking our heads. I think we've heard
that. We completely relate, Ruth.
Right. Well, I think you do have an ease of saying something, a retort to your own mom. You'd be a little more
reticent to say it to
a daughter-in-law.
Absolutely. It takes years to build that trust, and hopefully in a good relationship when you both helped each other in the good times and the bad times, you begin to build that trust and know you can count on each other.
Well, Ruth, let me ask you this one. You know, grandparents these days, they're busy. I mean, we're not just going off into the sunset, and, you know, some of us might have jobs. We have busy lives. So what if we feel that we're being a bit taken advantage of? You know, we love watching the child, you know, or the baby, right, or even as they get older, but they might ask a bit too often. What do you advise? What should we do?
I'd be really frank about it and say, you know, I love your kids and I love to babysit, but I also have a job and I also have community obligations. And I have to be honest with you that I feel I can't do it quite as often. So can we maybe have a signal between us that when you really need me, you will tell me and I will, you know, jump through hoops to accommodate you. But when it's an optional thing, I'd be appreciative if you would tell me that also.
Oh, I'm taking notes on that one, Ruth. That was very good. Oh,
she doesn't even have anyone married yet.
No, it's going to be years and I'm going to forget that sage advice.
We'll have to have Ruth back.
That's right. So on the opposite side, what happens if you actually want to watch the kids more often, but you're not really asked?
Well, that can be tricky. So I would mention that you would like to do it. You could ask, are there ways that I could be helpful to you? Would it be helpful, for example, if I picked up the child at daycare? Would it be helpful if I watched the soccer game? In other words, are there ways that you could babysit that would actually be helpful to the parents, perhaps in terms of tasks that take a lot of time, but aren't the official babysitting route?
And certainly this is if you're lucky enough to live nearby your wonderful grandchildren.
Yes. So if you don't, this is more complicated. But fortunately, we have oodles and oodles of technology. And, you know, I think in my first book about parents and adult children, I write about continental family. One lived in Europe, one in America. And the grandfather would call in every day when the father was having his coffee. And he would entertain the toddler with, you know, songs and, you know, stories while the father was in the room, because obviously you can't leave a toddler alone, but was at least able to sit down and have his coffee in peace and quiet.
Aww. Oh, that's Aww. So sweet. We'll be Isn't Skyping with story? Our grandchildren or whatever.
Right. But also, I would say with older grandchildren, you know, grandparents are learning to text because that's where our grandkids are.
Sure. So, and Google chatting.
Exactly.
Google chatting.
Right.
And even Facebook, for, you know. And, of course, asking your grandchildren to teach you all these things makes them feel terrific.
Well, family relationship expert Ruth Nemzoff, thank you so much for sharing your sage advice, as always, with the Two Boomer Babes.
It was my pleasure.
Have you ever dreamed of hanging a Da Vinci, Van Gogh, or a Renoir in your living room? Get this. High-end art is not just for the rich and famous. Recently, much of the world's greatest art has become available for free so that anyone just about anywhere can now stream a masterpiece.
ArtKick is a new app that brings billions of dollars of fine art to your home TV and turns it into a digital frame for your enjoyment without costing a cent. ArtKick CEO Sheldon Laub joins us from Manhattan to tell us about this ingenious app. Welcome, Sheldon.
Hi.
Hey, so how exactly does this thing work?
It's really simple. As you said already, it's art for free on your TV. And there are really two parts to it. One is a little app you install on any phone or tablet, iOS or Android. You go to the Google Play Store or the iOS App Store and download ArtKick.
Hmm.
And then you can connect it up to your TV. And to connect it up to your TV, you need either an internet-connected TV. That's one of those new smart TVs. Or for $35, you can get one of those new Google Chromecast that you see advertised on TV. Or a Roku box. So it's only $35 to connect your old TV to the internet. And then we connect those two things up and offer you a library of over 50,000 of the world's greatest pieces of art.
Wow. Well, Sheldon, are flat screen TVs internet connected TVs?
Well, not all of them. Only ones which are smart TVs.
Ooh.
But if you don't have an internet connected TV, as I said, it's $35 for a Google Chromecast, and that's a little key you plug in, and it connects your TV to the internet.
That's so cheap, and now then we'll have smart TVs, Barbara. Well, Sheldon, with this app, can we have playlists? You know, of art to choose from, like our favorites will pop up in our certain lists.
Exactly. It's just like music. you know, in music, you have your own favorite music and your own favorite playlist. We have things called view lists, which are views of art, and you pick whichever your favorites are. We, of course, have hundreds of preset ones, such as, you know, the best of Impressionism or Modernism or, you know, as you said, Monet or Klimt. But you can find the art you like. You can search for it, or you can just sort of browse through and say, add this to my own view list.
And then you
can have your favorites.
Can we schedule it to kind of rotate every day? We get a new gorgeous masterpiece?
Exactly. You can do it every day, at your choice, every hour, even every 10 minutes if you're sort of attention deficit disordered. Well, you also can import your own personal photos.
Well, what's the process? So we download the app. So where exactly, again, do we get that app?
You get that app. The easiest thing to do is go to artkick.com, our website, and then there are links to download the app, and it's free.
Okay.
And you start up the app, and you log into it, and then you simply press the button that says Connect TV, and that'll give you the instructions of how to connect it up to your TV.
Well, Sheldon, where do you get these images? I mean, do you have to have agreements with, like, private collectors and museums? The Louvre?
Well, it turns out we have agreements with contemporary artists to offer their art on ArtKit, but it turns out masterpieces like those in the Louvre are already in the public domain. We, however, just because they're in the public domain doesn't mean it's they're in a digital form, and so we have to get digital images of those great photos, organize them, and categorize them and catalog them and put them into ArtKit. So we have a large curation process to make those images available to you.
Is there a particular painting, or you also have photographs too, we understand, that's really downloaded a lot, that's more popular than any other?
Well, right now, we're starting to keep statistics on some of the most popular paintings. And, of course, one of the most popular is Nighthawks by Edward Hopper. That's that great picture you see of people sitting in a diner. And for some reason, that's a really popular image. It's popular when people buy posters, and it's popular on ArtKit. But also popular are some wonderful images from space. We have some great images from the Hubble Space Telescope, which are absolutely beautiful. And, of course, what's really popular is people import their own images. And so you can have on your TV in your last vacation, and you can sort of mix and match them with great pieces of art. You can have your granddaughter, you know, next to the Mona Lisa.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome. Well, Sheldon Law, CEO of ArtKick, we babes can't wait to have our friends over to see our extensive masterpiece collection on our own TVs. They're going to be so impressed.
I'm sure they will. Have a great time with it. It's art for free on your TV.
Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Have a great day.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.